people have a conversation, Mr. Farmer, proceed. You said you had carried certain high workers to the Plaquemine office.
Yes.
In the hope of mollifying the blanket anti-white sentiment.
Yes.
There.
Yes, it appeared to succeed, at least in part. I don't know how deep the success was, but these individual white persons were finally accepted by the Negro community. They were accepted as individuals, and in a sense, removed from the white race and accepted into the Negro race. They were considered exceptions. As in the case of one young lady who was working for CORE down there, it became really a part of the Negro community. And I visited later, was talking with some of the Negroes, and they said, well, yes, she is white, but she's the blackest white woman we've ever seen. So I'm not sure that there is a carryover from their response to these individuals.
You mean the real carryover, if I'm interpreting you right, would be to say not the blackest white woman, but a human being.
A human being, yes, exactly. I suspect that we are in for not only a long, hot summer, but to use that now cliche, but for a long, dark night of polarization between the races. I think it's a temporary thing, and that we'll get over it if we can avoid destructive violence in the meantime.
There are two thoughts that come from that, from what you have said. One is this, speaking of the widening gap between Negro and white you're talking about.
Yes.
What about the widening gap that is pointed out by, well, many people, Mr. Whitney Young being one, between the Negro masses, the slum, and the successful middle class, upper class?
Yes.
The draining off of leadership, you know, in terms of economic split.
Thing. Yes, I was just about to come to that. This is heightening very rapidly in the Negro community now. You find the schism between the middle class and the working class Negro. We find it within CORE.
The non-working class.
Non-working class, the unemployed.
The unemployed.
Yes. We find it within CORE, since the CORE chapters have become mass movements. People have walked in off the streets and joined the organization, and we've wanted them. We have longed for their presence in the organization. So we are pleased that this has happened. Yet we find an increasing tension between the established Negro middle class and the Negro, quote, lower class, unquote. Sometimes it shows itself in superficialities such as who wears a coat and a tie and who doesn't wear a coat and a tie. Who has a car and who doesn't have a car. Who lives in a house in the country and who lives in a tenement slum in New York. Sometimes it becomes a status symbol to live in a tenement slum.
Inverted status.
Inverted status, yes. I think this is very unfortunate. If there's anything that the Negro in this country cannot afford, it's that class delineation and conflict. We can't afford that kind of division.
Either way. But now, what can be done about it if there's this distrust or lack of contact with the leadership that has come from, it's bound to come from the educated classes of Negroes. Now, if there's a loss of contact there, then what's the next thing? What is the danger of the next thing?
I didn't quite understand
the question. The leadership, by and large, naturally,
yes,
has come,
yeah,
from, as it always does come, from, mm-hmm, people of education and mm-hmm, and who've had opportunities and who have a chance for reflection.
Mm-hmm.
It's come from middle and upper class Negroes.
Yes.
College people, this, right, and with a few exceptions, but by and large. Now, but if the gap is widening between that class and the masses, the unemployed and the unemployables, and the slum casual work on these people, depressed mass, if that gap is widening, then what?
Well, I think what we're finding happening now is that a number of new Negro leaders are springing up from the Negro working class and the lower class generally. many of these persons have not had much education. They have developed a feeling, however, for the struggle for civil rights. They've developed some felicity in the use of the techniques of nonviolent direct action. And I suspect that some of them will grow in prominence.
If they follow that general line of growth, good and well.
Yes.
But there are so many possibilities of other lines of development from because of this split. Theoretically, it would seem to be.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if the nonviolence and the general policies that you represent are taped as belonging to the now alienated middle class, upper class Negro, educated
mm-hmm.
Negro,
mm-hmm.
then the other leader has his gambit in denying that policy. I mean, possible leaders.
Well,
What signs of that danger are there now, if any? Am I making myself clear?
Not quite clear.
Well, I mean, if there's a real alienation or movement toward alienation between the now leadership class of the Negro movement, people of education, people of various sorts of contact with the world outside, this class alienated from the slum Negro. Now, the slum leaders, as they arise, some, as you indicated, will follow the same line that is now followed by basic Negro leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the great temptation, either for power or out of ignorance and a sense of oppression and desperation, to follow a line of violence in the slum leadership. It was seen in the cards.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true, really. I think that one finds just about as much anger now among the Negro middle class as one finds among the lower class.
But does the lower class identify with this anger in the middle class? Was the gap so great he can't conceive of that, so the middle-class Negro looks like an alien to him.
He looks like an alien. He looks like a person who is no longer black. He's white.
The white collar makes him white.
Yes, makes him white. A favorite saying now on Negroes is, so-and-so is, he used to be black. I heard somebody refer to Ralph Bunche in that way. What do you think of Ralph Bunche, you know? Well, he used to be black, but now has become white. I think what is more apt to happen is that there'll be great attrition among Negro leadership now, based in large part upon the fastness of the footwork, whether people are able to adapt to the vocabulary and the terminology. Of the masses, yes. Look at one man who has such fast footwork and adaptability as Adam Clayton Powell. Now, Powell has no real relationship with the rank-and-file lower-class Negroes.
He flatters himself that he hasn't.
Hmm?
He flatters himself that he does have it.
Yes.
Well, one thing he claims to have.
He hasn't really. He's far removed. Powell with three houses, you know, and four cars. And,
he says, I'm the only slum dweller among all Negro leaders.
But he is not a slum dweller. He keeps officially a little apartment someplace in Harlem. But this mansion in Puerto Rico and a house in White Plains and everything else, yet Powell knows the rhetoric. He knows the rhetoric and he can speak to it. He can use it and he becomes thus a lower class Negro leader, which is the most ironic thing you can imagine. Malcolm, another one. Now, Malcolm is not lower class. Malcolm has a home out in Jamaica, in Long Island, house and yard. Malcolm drives a new Oldsmobile. Malcolm wears $200 suits and expensive handmade shirts. But Malcolm has the rhetoric and the footwork to keep in pace with the changing mood of the people. He doesn't lead them, but he reflects it and verbalizes what they are thinking. So I suspect that there's going to be an attrition among Negro leadership depending upon their adaptability to this and their ability to speak with the proper vocabulary. Now, Baldwin is a writer who has that vocabulary and thus has appeal to the lower-class Negro. I have been absolutely amazed to see lower-class Negroes, working-class unemployed and unemployed Negroes, reading Baldwin's books, probably the first books they've read, reading them laboriously, but reading them. I'm sure not understanding what he's saying, but getting a feeling that I dig this guy because he digs me. He's saying what I would like to say.
Now, the other question that came to mind out of what you said earlier was this, about this gap between the white man and the Negro. You see, it was an increasing gap.
Yes.
Many people tend to think that the problem is one of extirpating prejudice, stamping it out, pulling it out of the roots.
Yes.
Now, maybe that isn't the immediate problem on the white part of white man or Negro either. You see, there's mutual prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And in some quarters, increasing prejudice, as you have pointed out. Maybe the point is to know what to do with the prejudice. What's recognized? To transcend the prejudice in terms not of saying, take it, we don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
But say, what do we do now that we have it? We've got it. Is that a different problem psychologically, isn't it?
Well, I think it is.
Morally.
I think it is, very much so.
But isn't there a kind of sentimentality on both sides of the fence among certain people that you extirpate prejudice for social solutions and then get to social solutions?
Yes, there is indeed. It runs into a great deal of it. Sometimes it's put in the context of whether we're for legislation or not. And you cannot legislate the prejudice out of the hearts of men. Somehow you've got to find some way of getting it out otherwise, but laws won't reach it. When actually the laws don't try to speak to prejudice. They merely try to control men's behavior so that whatever prejudice they have does not illegally damage other citizens.
Now, is the stage to make people confront their prejudice rather than try to persuade them they don't have any?
Of course, exactly.
Rather than try to persuade they don't have any?
Yes, exactly.
That's what I'm getting at.
So this is one thing.
For you is to say, you don't have it, I don't have it.
Yeah. This is what we've been trying to say in the North. And the reason we started stepping up our demonstrations in the North more than a year ago, because so many Northerners deceived themselves into thinking that they were not prejudiced. The ideal thing was to be without prejudice, so they asserted that they were without prejudice, when nothing could have been farther from the truth. We hoped through some of the demonstrations that we undertook to force them to confront their own prejudices and to admit that they existed, then determine what they were going to do about it. I think we partially succeeded in that.
That's the point I'm getting at.
Yeah.
As opposed to the sentimental view that you persuade each other you don't have it.
Right. I think that this is a more realistic interpretation of what is happening today than the concept of the white backlash. And people are confronting the feelings which heretofore have been submerged.
Now, a question related to that. There are some people who take the Negro movement or revolution or problem in the light of good guys against bad guys, evil against good.
Well, I of course, do not believe in the devil theory of history, nor do I think that there are angels, and that anyone who happens to be opposed to us is a completely depraved human being. What we always try to say in the nonviolent direct action movement, and I confess that as we grow larger, we get farther away from it, we try to look at the enemy and say, there but for the grace of God go I, and to realize that he is in large measure the creature of his environment and of the conditioning, the social conditioning, and that if our experiences have been identical with his, then we probably would share many of his present biases. It is this belief and this platform which has served as the philosophical, theoretical basis of the nonviolent movement.
Now, Matt, to say it back, you place the moral issue in the context of human conditioning.
Yes. Yes.
So with the reckless of conditioning is the equivalent of forgiveness.
Exactly. And also it recognizes the possibility of human change.
But by the same token.
By the same token.
Let's jump ahead a second. Let's take a time, date unspecified, when there'll be fair employment, practice, and there'll be decent housing legislation with some teeth in it, and things, voter registration, all the rest, those things, those obvious things that we now find the bones of a contention, points of struggle. Then what? What remains to be done?
Well,
suppose we have those things.
You're assuming that then we have broken down the walls.
Broken down. You have at least official integration.
Yeah.
You have reasonably fair employment situations,
yes.
Integrated schools,
right.
Those things.
Then you have to
then
build
what?
The bridges. First the walls come down, then the bridges go up. Then the thrust changes from desegregation to integration. And here one's definition of integration becomes very pertinent.
At this point.
At this point.
Now, at this point, what is the Negro's responsibility? What is his, in this phase of the
sort of phase,
what's his responsibility?
Well, he has many responsibilities. One of the chief responsibilities is to prepare himself to live in an integrated society.
As you have a parallel to the white man's problem, then.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a difficult situation because we're moving against that now, moving away from it. In the Negro community, there's a greater sentiment toward nationalism. And after we have broken down the walls, it's really a contradictory and confused type of struggle. Many of the same people who speak in behalf of segregation are one day or the next day fighting against specific forms of segregation. The Malcolm X's, for example, when Malcolm joined the second school boycott, which was obviously for desegregation of the schools, yet he speaks for separation. I've sort of lost the point here now.
Now, we're talking about the paradox of the Negro's responsibilities being parallel to the white man's responsibilities on the question of integration. This, after we have the formal matters taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
You see, after we have, desegregation of schools, fair employment practice,
yeah.
The teeth in it, these things, all the things now, civil rights and so forth, voting.
After we have all of that, and if these laws that we have are implemented and enforced,
let's assume that.
Then Negro leadership will either have to change its focus or Negro leadership itself will have to change or be changed. It's pretty much like the trade union operation. I spent some years as a trade union organizer. And when the organizers began organizing and preparing for an NLRB election, we had to be agitators. Our work was an agitational work. The boss was a beast, had to be the slogan. But then after we had won the election, we found that we had to live with the boss. We had to sit down with the boss, and we had to negotiate a contract which controlled our activities as well as his activities. What we usually had to do was to pull out the organizer and then send in others, send in negotiators.
Who wouldn't have to take it back.
Who wouldn't have to take it back, but they could start fresh, Well, that was somebody else who said that.
He was mistaken.
Yes, I'm saying something different. Now, sometimes you find a rare individual who can do both.
Yeah.
But that's extraordinary.
Now we're up against the question of the tactics.
Yes.
Psychological tactics. On one hand, if you preach, say, the study of Negro history.
Yes.
You see. It has a double appeal. One is bound to be to chauvinism, to erase superiorities. Inevitably, have that component enters into it. Inevitably. There's a casualty possible there, like the casualty in the study of Southern history.
Yes.
I mean, the Confederacy has become a city of the soul, or something, so on, you see. Hard to keep the facts straight. That liability to build great reasonable pride, you have to build irrational pride.
Mm-hmm.
This is carrying the same in boss beast problem.
That's right.
Does leadership just simply envisage this problem as inevitable risk, or is something that can be kept at a rational level in the process?
I think it can be kept at a rational level in the process. I think it is important that in the teaching of Negro history in schools it not be taught as a separate subject, but be taught in terms of the Negro's contribution to American history, just as we study the contributions of other peoples in American history. I think it is possible, I certainly think it is possible, for the Negro to be proud of contributions that have been made by people who happen to have been Negroes, but to be equally proud of contributions that have been made by other peoples, and equally proud of the cultures which other people represent.
It's tough, though, isn't it?
It's tough. But I've seen this sort of mutual pride in individuals, and I think it can be true in groups.
It can be within certain obvious limits. Let's shift.
Yeah.
What do you think of Lincoln?
What do I think of him?
Yes, as a man. How do you assess his, not his symbolic role, but his human and ethical role?
Well, it's so difficult that this far removed from him to look at the real Lincoln as opposed to the mythical.
It's difficult, yes.
Lincoln. And I'm not a Lincoln scholar, a Lincoln authority, so I'm not sure how much is myth and how much was the man. My own opinion, however, is that Lincoln was not the great emancipator as he is generally pictured to be. From some of his quotes, which I do not think were taken out of context, Lincoln's...
There's a strong piece of a lot of evidence on
yes,
that point.
Yes, that his objective was not really to free the Negroes. His objective was to save the Union.
He said so.
Yeah. Of course.
He also was a racist in a sense.
He didn't believe in intermarriage, one thing.
He just said inferiority, period.
Yeah.
So did Jefferson.
Of course. I think though, that here you've got to look at these men in their historical context. They were not omniscient and were not able to speak from the vantage point of the anthropological and sociological and psychological knowledge that we have now.
Dealing with the de facto inferiority, they said this is not historical. He said historically, but he said this is absolute.
Yeah, that's right.
As they looked around,
they thought it was absolute. Well, people always consider things to be absolute when they're not aware of the historical context.
Now, what you are saying, to say it back to myself, that you will not make abstract moral judgments. You will say you must put them in their historical context.
I think we must, yes. I think we must.
That's right. Tie that to your previous remarks about anyone's prejudices at any given moment. It's conditioned by history, by personal history.
His prejudices are conditioned.
As conditioned by his personal history and the society he's grown up in.
Yes, that's right.
And just tying this general historical relativism to the other thing you said about the personal prejudices. Say, every person's raised in a body of prejudices.
Yes.
How does he transcend? He's conditioned to them.
Yes.
How does he transcend them?
How does he transcend them?
You said that, growth in moral awareness.
Growth in moral awareness.
But I was just tying the general historical principle that you said about individuals, all I'm trying to do.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I would certainly accept
that. That's all. I was just trying to put them in the same package.
I would accept
psychologically.
That.
What about Kennedy?
President Kennedy?
Mm-hmm. Was he in the process of growth, do you think? Or do you know?
Okay, oh, Kennedy, I think he was growing some. I certainly am almost nauseated by the current deification of Kennedy, especially on the civil rights issue, because this is not accurate, historically accurate. The relationship which I had with him were valid at all. I had several conversations with him, and my feeling was that the president did intellectualize the civil rights issue and intellectualized it well, but I saw no depth of feeling there on his part. It became a rather cold intellectual issue and a political issue with him. He moved only when there was sufficient pressure that he had to move.
Birmingham being the big watershed.
Birmingham was the big watershed, yes. It was only after Birmingham that he came out saying that this was a moral issue, you know. Before then, it had been a legal issue.
Do you think that part of the deification has been because of the Negro need for a symbol?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the Negro had anything to do with the deification of Kennedy. The Negro merely accepted the deification which was with which he was stampeded through the mass media.
As useful, cynically, as a useful symbol, or just ignorantly accepting it?
Oh, no, ignorantly accepting it. One accepts it, you know, it's superimposed and doesn't rationalize it or think it through.
Have you seen Harry Golden's book called Kennedy and the Negro?
I have a copy of it, yes. I've only scanned it and haven't read it carefully.
Well, you won't agree with it.
Yeah, I don't think I'll agree with it.
That's what you said.
Yeah. But,
he makes him the second coming.
Oh, yes. Well, this is not unusual, you know, for a man to become in his death what he was not in his life on an issue like this. It's happened many times before.
How do you take John Brown? Have you read his...
Oh, I've read his works. Yeah, I think he was an extremely dedicated person and got intoxicated, from what I observed. So this is his destiny.
Yes, he did.
I know, speaking of the very frequent making a man what he was not before his death, the ILGWU was going to give an award to Sidney Hillman for civil rights activity. Someone asked Dubinsky, but Dubinsky, Sidney Hillman didn't do anything in civil rights. But when did he become a great civil rights leader? Dubinsky, with his great wisdom, said, after he died.
When Lincoln died, Kurowski just kind of kept a diary down in the back room, you know, said, now dies the man, now he's born the myth.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I think really that Johnson is much more pro-civil rights than Kennedy was.
That's my impression without knowing nearly as much about it as you do.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to be sneering at Lincoln. I admire Lincoln. I think you were lucky to get him. Considering what you could have gotten, I think he was a great man.
Yeah.
I wasn't using that as a cover attack on Lincoln.
Yeah.
It was just a... Well, I'm now feel that the nags of the occasion. Let's knock it off.
Okay.
End of conversation, Mr. Farmer.